Keep Talking exists to have conversations that might help to make a better society and a better culture. I believe that each guest has important information and stories to make public. This is the Keep Talking podcast. To support it, please take a second and subscribe to the show. It helps to make this content possible. What in the last 2 years since I've seen you is valuable information or a change of opinion for you, if there's anything that comes to mind that may be an addendum, something additional to the first conversation that we have that might be of interest to people listening to this, watching this, who are just concerned or interested in health? There are some more specific detailed subjects I'd love to go into, but maybe we can start with a broad question like that and then get into some of the more detailed subjects I want to cover.
Sure, Dan. You know, embarrassingly, I make most of my conclusions from making mistakes, big mistakes, like making myself a type 2 diabetic 30 some years ago when I decided to become low-fat vegan and damage my health. I'm back out of it, of course, as have many of my patients who I helped do that years ago. But a recent discovery came through a clinical trial I performed in ladies. You know, we do this thing where we restore this lost microbe, Lactobacillus reuteri. Virtually everybody has lost that microbe because it's very susceptible to common antibiotics. So you may have taken, let's say, amoxicillin 20 years ago for an upper respiratory infection or a urinary tract infection or whatever. And we've lost that microbe. Almost nobody has it anymore, despite the fact that that microbe, Lactobacillus reuteri, is ubiquitous in mammals, in hunter-gatherer human populations, unexposed to modern factors like antibiotics. They all have it. We don't. We lost it. Well, what happens when you restore it? Well, wonderful things happen. There's a restoration of youthful muscle. There's specific loss of abdominal fat. There's preservation of bone density. There's an amplification of the immune response. There's an acceleration of healing. There's provocation of oxytocin release from the brain that in turn causes an increase in the intensity of love and affection for people close to you, increased generosity, increased acceptance of other people's opinions, an increase in libido. Older guys experience a 50% rise in testosterone. Ladies experience older ladies who have vaginal atrophy, which is very common and a very bad problem to have. It's restored. Vaginal moisture and sensation is restored. In other words, all these youthful effects emerge. Well, I wanted to validate some of these effects and talk to my audience, which is largely female. They all said this: oh, we don't care about empathy and generosity and muscle. We just want better skin. And I thought, what? Are you serious? Oh, okay, fine. So I did a skin clinical trial, 25 ladies, and we made measures like a high-resolution skin ultrasound. It's a way to measure the dermal layer of skin. It's the dermal layer just beneath the external epidermis. It's the dermal layer of skin, Dan, that is the primary determinant of whether you have wrinkles, crow's feet, crepey skin, blemishes. It comes from the dermis, the physiologically active layer of skin. So we measured the dermal layer, and it increased. We gave these ladies a formulation that included Lactobacillus reuteri and some other things to augment the effect. And I asked them, don't change your diet, don't change your exercise program, just get these four components. Lactobacillus reuteri in combination with marine source collagen peptides, hyaluronic acid, and astaxanthin, the carotenoid. Things largely lacking in modern diets, because one of the reasons for that is because we've been told this ridiculous advice to cut fat and cholesterol in the diet, saturated fat and cholesterol, for which there was never any good evidence. And when people do that, they often abandoned consumption of organ meats rich in collagen and hyaluronic acid. And astaxanthin, just a carotenoid like beta carotene, largely absent from the diet because people get ultra-processed foods with white flour, sugar, hydrogenated oils. They get food through a fast food drive-through window. All the reasons that people have garbage diets now. Well, replace those four things. We did measure a dramatic increase in dermal thickness. Ladies were happy. The participants in the study were happy because they lost their crow's feet. They lost their smile lines here. The depth of their forehead wrinkles and the nasolabial fold was diminished. Their skin was more moist. They were real happy. But they also lost several inches off their waist. Dan, we didn't change the diet. Didn't change it. So At first, I saw these data. What? This can't be right, right? And did not lose much weight, maybe a third of a pound average. Well, how can you lose up to 8.5 inches off your waist and not lose weight? Increase muscle. So that's what we see in mice. That's what we see in humans. Dramatic increase in muscle. It's a kind of a restoration of the muscle you had when you were 25. You know, as we age, we lose about a third of our muscle mass, sometimes 50%. It comes back. So I stumbled, Dan, through this crazy little skin clinical trial. We just happened to measure waist circumference. I stumbled on a way, I think, to restore youthful body composition, specific targeting of abdominal fat, and a restoration of youthful muscle. The exact opposite, by the way, of these awful, awful, awful GLP-1 agonist drugs, like Wegovy, Ozempic, and Mounjaro. Those drugs specifically target subcutaneous fat, not abdominal. Abdominal visceral fat, Dan, is the source of almost all the problems associated with being overweight or obese. It's the source of inflammation, insulin resistance, risk for breast cancer, heart disease, dementia. Not subcutaneous fat, that is fat below the skin. So those drugs are specifically targeting subcutaneous. That's why people look 10 to 20 years older when they so-called Ozempic face. You lose 40 pounds, you look like you're 20 years older. So they lose subcutaneous fat preferentially, and they lose a huge amount of muscle. Typically 25% of the weight loss, sometimes as much as 50% of the weight loss is muscle. Well, that impairs your health long-term. That's why when you stop the drug, this is well-established, you stop the drug because you can't afford it forever. Most people can't afford it forever. You stop the drug, you regain. Let's say you lost 40 pounds in the beginning, 10 pounds was muscle, 30 pounds fat. You regain 32 to 34 pounds of fat, not muscle. Now you're more at risk for type 2 diabetes, heart disease, dementia, breast cancer, and other conditions than you were at the start. Pharma pockets your $12,000 to have you become less healthy and fat again. That's what pharma is doing. Well, I think I stumbled on a way to circumvent all those problems involving no drugs. Now, one of the questions that you and I talked about is, what if we did those things concurrently and preserved muscle, didn't lose muscle? We don't know what happens because we've not done the clinical trial. We're looking for a partner with deep pockets to do that because it'd be very expensive to do. But I think we may also have found kind of an antidote to all the problems associated with, well, I shouldn't say all the problems, but many of the problems associated with GLP-1 agonists.
You brought up that phrase, which I was just reviewing our conversation from a couple of years ago, and this was a terminology and a phrase I didn't know before speaking to you, lactobacillus reuteri. And it might be helpful for people just to do a quick refresh as to what has led, in your estimation, to the elimination or the massive reduction in that bacteria in people. You just talked about some of the potential benefits of restoring that to one's system, one's biology. What do we know about how it disappears, and what do we also know about how it can be given back to the body in a way that might be able to help people in the way you just articulated?
Well, Lactobacillus reuteri is actually one among hundreds of species that have been lost. So there's many more, and that's a whole conversation of its own. We could also restore Lactobacillus gasseri. We could restore Lactobacillus crispatus. We could restore Lactobacillus jensenii or NC or Bifidobacterium longum. There's a whole bunch of really cool microbes that you can play with. As I mentioned in the beginning, Dan, I've made many of my findings based on blundering mistakes. I chose Lactobacillus reuteri just for fun because there was some interesting evidence in mice, and I started restoring it in humans. We do that by making a yogurt, not the stuff in the store. It looks and smells like yogurt. It's not yogurt. You can't buy it in the store. All that is, though, making a yogurt out of it is a way to increase the microbial counts 1,000-fold. One of the problems with probiotics, commercial probiotics, is they're very expensive to make microbes. And so these manufacturers who sell probiotics, they put low numbers in the capsules because it's very expensive. No one wants to pay $200 or $300 for a month's worth of probiotics. So they put these low numbers in. Well, I got this microbe that was well studied by a group at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. They used a strain of reuteri that was commercially available for babies because it reduced regurgitation of breast milk and formula and had some other beneficial effects like abbreviated diarrhea after a course of antibiotics. So I got this microbe and we fermented it as yogurt. I did something called flow cytometry. It's a laser-assisted method of counting microbes. And we're getting something like 300 billion per half cup serving using prolonged fermentation, not like the way they do it in a factory to make yogurt for the grocery store. I used extender, prolonged fermentation. We also fertilized the growth of microbes by adding prebiotic fibers. Well, you do those, it's very easy. It sounds more complicated than it is. It's very easy. 36 hours, we get these 300 billion microbes per half, and people store it, and all those wonderful things happen. Oxytocin, increased love and attention and affection, generosity, increased muscle, increased libido, preservation of bone density, and all those wonderful effects. But we've lost this microbe because it is very susceptible to common. This is established facts, very susceptible, as are many microbes, probiotic microbes. There's probably many other factors that go into decimating the gastrointestinal microbiome, but this has not been well charted. But that list is likely to include glyphosate, the active ingredient in the herbicide Roundup. Glyphosate is an herbicide, yes. It's also an antibiotic, but specific for killing beneficial microbes and is ineffective against fecal microbes like E. coli and salmon. So it selects for unhealthy microbes in the GI tract. There's other things like preservatives in food that inhibit mold growth, but also inhibit microbes in your GI tract. Emulsifying agents like polysorbate 80 that you find in such foods as ice cream and salad dressing to keep them mixed. But that also emulsifies or dissolves the mucus barrier in your gastrointestinal tract, inviting inflammation and changes in microbial composition. Stomach acid blocking drugs, which are very common, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, a long list of things that likely conspired to decimate the composition of the gastrointestinal microbiome. And among the casualties is this microbe I chose first to play with, just by sheer dumb luck, Dan. Lactobacillus reuteri. There are other very important microbes, but reuteri is probably at the top of the list for the the effect on oxytocin and its effects on youthfulness and sociability, social behavior. But it also has another aspect of its behavior. It also colonizes the small intestine. Most microbes don't do that. They colonize the colon, the last 4 to 5 feet of your gastrointestinal tract. But reuteri has the unique capacity to colonize from mouth to anus, 30 feet. But it's especially important in the small intestine, the 24 feet of small intestine, the duodenum, jejunum, and ileum, because reuteri takes up residence in those 24 feet of small intestine, where it produces what are called bacteriocins. These are natural antibiotics effective against fecal microbes. By my estimation, Dan, half the U.S. population has a peculiar situation because we lost all those beneficial microbes. Fecal microbes, E. coli, Salmonella, Citrobacter, Campylobacter, Pseudomonas, Proteus, all these microbes that are supposed to stay in the colon. The colon's perfectly happy with those microbes. Those are the microbes you pass out in the toilet when you go number two. But in half the U.S. population, those fecal microbes have been allowed to ascend and colonize the small intestine. Small intestine is not prepared, not suited to that. It's very permeable, has a single-layer mucus barrier, unlike the two-layer mucus barrier of the colon. And so it's very permeable. That's where we're supposed to absorb nutrients like vitamins and minerals and amino acids. So the small intestine, when it's colonized by fecal microbes, now these microbes only live for a few hours. They don't live very long. So there's trillions of microbes in the 24 feet of small intestine living and dying rapidly. When they die, they release some of their toxic compounds. One is called endotoxin. And when it gets into the bloodstream through this very permeable small intestine, that's called endotoxemia. And endotoxemia is wildly out of control in the U.S. population. But you won't recognize it unless you realize that it could be manifested as rosacea or psoriasis or depression or suicide or dementia or Parkinson's disease or as restless leg syndrome or fibromyalgia or type 2 diabetes or obesity, on and on. All the things that we look around and see modern people are suffering with, these are in great part, not entirely, but in great part, caused or driven by microbes, fecal microbes living in the small intestine, so-called small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. We say SIBO, S-I-B-O. mm-hmm. and the endotoxemia that allows.
You said in our conversation 2 years ago, and I think this is almost a direct quote, that 90% or more of all the body's serotonin comes from the GI tract, which is a rather unbelievable thing to hear. You know, for people that hear the statement you just made and are interested in learning more and trying lifestyle changes or a change in their diet to try to help them with this, I guess the first question would be, one, how can one identify if they are one of these 50% that you were talking about that are dealing with this, suffering from this? And then number two, the yogurt you mentioned, and I think a couple years ago you had mentioned that you were potentially looking to find ways to make this more widely available for people to try. What can people do to try to help to improve their life with this? Are there any yogurts available or substances that might be available for them to try?
No, there's no commercial yogurts. Getting into the refrigerated aisle with an expensive, costly product is a very difficult thing to do. So I've not done that. So one way would be get the microbe, and the microbe that we use most commonly, there's several sources. One source is the company BioGaia, BioGaia. It's a Swedish company. They have a product called Osfortis. There's a product called Cutting Edge Cultures L. reuteri Superfood. And we are coming out with a source of reuteri also that you can either take as a probiotic or make yogurt. So both ways. I also did formulate a product for that skin. I don't mention the name just because of regulatory restrictions, but you can get it from those commercial products, or you can just get any of those products and ferment it as yogurt. The great advantage of that is, one, higher counts, 300 billion. The product we're coming out with will be 20 billion per capsule. The Osfortis is 5 billion per capsule. So the yogurt is 300 billion per half cup serving. And you don't have to buy it again because you can make the future batches from a little of a prior batch. So it's very easy to do. And that, by the way, Dan, is true for most microbes that have probiotic properties. You can ferment, for instance, Lactobacillus gasseri. We use the BNR17 strain and it shrinks your waste. We can ferment Bifidobacterium infantis. If you give that to a baby, it has better neurological maturation, less likely to have asthma and type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes later in life. And that child has a higher IQ. A woman can replace Lactobacillus crispatus. Makes a delicious yogurt, by the way. And when a woman replaces it, because about a third of the female population of the world has lost it, women who don't have it are more likely to have a miscarriage, more likely to have premature labor and delivery of a premature baby. She's more prone to vaginal infections, like vaginal candida infections. She's more prone to urinary tract infections. So you restore Lactobacillus crispatus. Remarkably, Dan, it's an illustration of a process called translocation. A woman can take Lactobacillus crispatus orally, and it colonizes the vagina. There's no connection between the GI tract and the vagina. There's nearness, contiguity in the perineum and the groin area. And even more remarkably, crispatus colonizes the bladder. You know, for forever, we thought the bladder was sterile. It's not sterile. It's got a microbiome. And among the most important key microbes is Lactobacillus crispatus. If a woman restores this microbe, she cuts her risk of repeated urinary tract infections by half. You know, repeated urinary tract infection is a crippling problem for a lot of ladies. With each round of antibiotics every few months, their health deteriorates further. So here's a way not to maybe eliminate, but cut back a lot on the risk of repeated urinary tract infections, and it reduces what's called urge incontinence. These are older ladies who laugh or cough or sneeze, and they pee. Very embarrassing, right, for a woman. Well, crispatus reduces that quite significantly. So it's an illustration of what we can accomplish with microbes. There are microbes that reduce uric acid, hyperuricemia, and gout. There are microbes that reduce oxalate that cause oxalate kidney stones. We're getting a grasp of so many incredible things that microbes can do. And yet we were indifferent to them for decades, right? You take an antibiotic, you got a couple of weeks of diarrhea, and the doctor says, don't worry, it'll come back. Your diarrhea will stop. And that was the end of the story. It was just a curiosity. But it's become clear we were neglecting an entire universe of beneficial effects.
And I know we talked about this a couple of years ago as well about fermented foods, something you've just mentioned there as well. And for, you know, a lay audience that may be stumbling upon this for the first time and they're interested in trying some of these offerings in their diet to try to help with some of the symptoms they may be experiencing. Am I right that fermenting any kind of food could help with, for example, the example that you just gave, that fermenting, for example, I know kimchi is something that you've talked about consuming could be helpful, but fermenting any kind of yogurt would help in this department with Lactobacillus reuteri, or is it more specific that people need to get to help with this specific area?
Yeah, if you want reuteri, you have to implant reuteri. You have to ferment reuteri. In other words, if you plant seeds for tomatoes, you don't get cucumbers. You get tomatoes. So same thing with microbes. Here's an easy way to kind of get everyone's thinking around fermentation of microbes. Two general classes of microbes. Microbes that ferment at human body temperature, like Lactobacillus reuteri, likes around 9,800 degrees Fahrenheit. Then there are room temperature fermenting microbes, and those are typically resident on the surface of vegetables and fruit. So two different kinds of microbes. So reuteri, human body temperature, Lactobacillus gasseri, Bifidobacterium infantis, those are all human body temperature. And they don't do well at room temperature. But there's a bunch of fermenting microbes that do fine. They reproduce at room temperature, like 70 degrees Fahrenheit. So for instance, as you point out, you make kimchi or kefir or sauerkraut or other fermented veggies, and you get species. This is really cool, Dan. You get species like Leuconostoc mesenteroides. I'm sorry about these names. Or Pediococcus pentosaceus or Weisella species. Well, these are species in fermented foods that you swallow, and they pass through the 30 feet of gastrointestinal tract, and you poop them out. They don't take up residence. So what good are they? Well, interestingly, in their passage through the GI tract, they somehow cultivate the proliferation of beneficial microbes. So they'll cause the proliferation of very beneficial species like Fecalobacterium or Acromantia or Ruminic Acacia. These are microbes triggered to proliferate by consumption of fermented foods. They're triggered to produce many good things, but among them, a fatty acid called butyric acid or butyrate. And butyrate, one, is very it's nutritious for the gastrointestinal lining, but it also enters the bloodstream, where it does things like gives you better sleep, reduces blood pressure, reduces blood sugar, reduces risk for diabetes and weight gain, helps shrink abdominal fat. I mean, numerous wonderful effects by consuming a fermented food with microbes that don't colonize. It took a while to figure this out. Some of the best work is from the husband-wife team at Stanford, the Sonnenbergs, Justin and Erica. They published a very important study to show that if there's one thing you can do to restore beneficial microbes, it's consume lots and lots and lots of fermented foods, even though those microbes themselves don't colonize us. But it's like a farmer. A farmer can plant all kinds of crops, and that's kind of what the fermenting microbes are. They're kind of like farmers for the gastrointestinal tract.
One of the things that I think is so interesting about this field of research, and I know I've heard you allude to this in the past, is contrasting field studies of modern hunter-gatherers or other cultures that do not consume the antibiotics that we do, the foods that we do, and noticing that certain, I think you've called them in the past, diseases of civilization are not present in these other cultures, indicating potentially that it's the way that we are living and the way that we are consuming that might be causing some of the issues that we have in our own civilization. I know one example that you've talked about is related to schizophrenia. I wanted to give some space to you to kind of double down on that general idea and have you speak at whatever length you would like to what we are beginning to learn in how we are living and the symptoms of certain illnesses that people are afflicted with in our civilization that are almost certainly caused not by some sort of inevitability, but by the way in which we are living in our civilization.
Isn't it amazing, Dan, that the anthropology community, the anthropologists, have known for nearly half a century that populations that are hunter-gatherers like the Yanomami in the Brazilian rainforest, or the Maasai in Kenya, or the Hadza in Tanzania, or people living in the jungles of New Guinea, or the east coast of Africa, the Malawi. These people don't develop type 2 diabetes, or coronary disease, heart disease, dementia. No hemorrhoids, no ulcerative colitis, no irritable bowel syndrome, no Crohn's disease, no colon cancer. I mean, on and on and on. They have other problems of their own. They have dengue fever and malaria, and they fall off a cliff and break their legs. So they have injury and infestations or infections. But they don't have these, so as you point out, the diseases of civilization. That's what the anthropologists call it. I think there's an important lesson there. Well, one of the things that make them different from us is they don't get antibiotics. They don't have chlorinated drinking water. They don't take stomach acid blocking drugs. They don't have emulsifying agents or mixing agents in their food. They just hunt and gather. They eat food as it was humans were supposed to. That is needs programmed in our genetic code over 3 million years of evolution. So they are spared. Now, how about their microbiome? So there have been groups that have looked at this, studied the microbiomes, the gastrointestinal microbiomes of these populations. And they're very different from us. They have microbes that we don't have. We have microbes they don't have. They have far greater numbers of microbes, greater so-called species diversity. And even more interestingly, despite being on separate continents separated by thousands of miles of ocean, the microbiomes of these populations look very similar to each other. So it's believed that they have the so-called Stone Age microbiome, that is the microbiome as it looked before all these modern factors entered the picture. Now, this opens a question, of course, should we mimic the composition of their microbiome? Well, not an easy thing to do because it's quite dramatically different. For instance, they have a bunch of things called spirochetes. And the only common spirochete in modern people is the one that causes syphilis. So they have tons of spirochetes. They have so it's a work in progress. How closely should we mimic the microbiome of those indigenous hunter-gatherer populations? Just not clear. And may not even be possible. It may not even be necessary. Maybe some of the adaptations we have are adaptive and good. Some of them are not good. But it's unclear where exactly that line is drawn and how far we should go in mimicking the composition of their gastrointestinal microbiome.
Is it your hunch that, you know, you just mentioned a few diseases, everybody in the U.S. has heard of dementia, Parkinson's, schizophrenia, that it's probably related to antibiotics and the side effects of antibiotic consumption that is leading to that phenomenon in our culture? Or do you suspect that it's probably something more aligned with what we're eating or something else?
Yeah, good point, Dan. It's both, of course. So the modern diet, we cut fat, saturated fat, cholesterol, which is a ridiculous idea. We abandoned consumption of organ meats rich in collagen and hyaluronic acid, for instance. We get ultra-processed food lacking carotenoids like beta-carotene, lutein, zeaxanthin, and astaxanthin. And we're told to consume plenty of healthy whole grains and everything in moderation. Well, that is a formula for disaster. It's a formula for massive for obesity on a massive scale, type 2 diabetes, dementia, heart disease. So in other words, conventional thinking about diet has also played a big role. And then, of course, the lousy diet most people follow has an impact on the composition of the microbiome, making things even worse. So it's a combination. So, you know, I arrived at this starting with diet. Talking about elimination of grains, stopping, urging people never cut calories. Cutting calories, by the way, Dan, is a disaster. You could do it by pushing the plate away, move more, eat less, many small meals all throughout the day, like the dietitians say, or it could be a pharmaceutical, like a GLP-1 agonist, like Wegovy or Ozempic, that makes you indifferent to food, makes you feel full with very little food, or it could be a bariatric procedure like lap band to constrict the stomach, or gastric bypass where they make the stomach a small little pouch. Those are all variations, Dan, on the same theme, reduction in calories. And we know with good evidence, when you reduce calories, you reduce your metabolic rate, the rate at which you burn calories, and you do it essentially permanently. You don't get it back for years and years and years. And when you cut calories, you increase appetite hormones. So if somebody loses, let's say, 40 pounds, whether it's a GLP-1 agonist or bariatric procedure, whatever. They did it by cutting calories, in effect, of that 40 pounds, 10 pounds is muscle, their metabolic rate typically drops by 25% or more. There was a recent study, for instance, at the NIH. They took people who are really big, BMI of 50 or greater, put them on a low-calorie diet and an intense exercise program, 2 hours a day, strength training, and aerobic exercise, strength training to try to minimize the loss of muscle. Well, they lost 126 pounds on average. Amazing, right? Of that 26 pounds, 23 pounds was muscle. And their metabolic rate plummeted so much so that if they ate anything more than 400 calories per day, which is nothing, right? Starvation. If they ate anything more than 400 calories, weight was regained. In other words, weight regain is guaranteed. All those methods guarantee weight regain because they lost muscle. So the bottom line here is never lose muscle. So we lose a third of our muscle or more with aging. When you lose weight by cutting calories, regardless of the method, regardless of how much money you paid to do it, you're going to lose muscle, and you thereby guarantee that you will regain the weight and mostly as fat, making you less healthy than you were at the start. This is the conventional path. So we've got to be smarter than that. Rearrange diet so you don't lose muscle, so you preferentially target abdominal visceral fat, and then restore microbes that play a role in all that.
I think you said earlier in this conversation that, you know, and earlier in your life that, and I totally identify with a theme you've mentioned a few times that you kind of learn through mistakes. I think that's generally how wisdom is earned in life. Enduring wisdom is through pain and failure. I'd love to talk, and I don't think we talked about this the first time that you and I had a chat a couple of years ago, but your own views on diet and a healthy diet. And I think you said a few minutes ago that at one point you were either a vegan or a vegetarian. I'd love to learn your evolution in terms of your general thinking about a healthy diet. I was a vegetarian for 7 years and then a pescatarian for 5. And now I've started to introduce some meat into my diet, mostly for health reasons, in addition to just the deliciousness of so many of those plates of food. But I'd love to give you space to give the listeners an arc of your own philosophy and thinking on that subject in general.
Sure. So this goes back now over 35 years. I was attending a meeting in Atlanta of the American College of Cardiology. That's where we learned about new technologies back then, the newest stents, the newest drill devices, all the ways we open people's arteries. That's what I was doing back then. And I heard Dr. Dean Ornish speak on his lifestyle heart trial, where he claims to have reversed heart disease in 28 people, which, by the way, he did not show that. He misinterpreted his evidence. He used the wrong method to quantify coronary disease and then made some mistakes. Whoever, he's not a cardiologist, he's a primary care guy, but the people who did the study for him made some mistakes, and they misrepresented the data. And by the way, of the 28 people who completed the trial over 5 years, 24 of them died, had heart attacks, had congestive heart failure, or had bypass surgery or catheterization or stent. In other words, there ain't no reversal here. It's nonsense. But I heard him make that claim. So I put myself on that diet he was advocating. That is an ultra low fat, less than 10% of calories from fat, no meat products, no added oil. So I did it. I became a disaster. Again, I was in my 30s. I was jogging, biking, playing tennis many times a week. I gained a bunch of weight. My abdomen, I got fat around the waist. My triglycerides went to 390, which is very high. My HDL cholesterol, the good, dropped to 27, which is a high-risk marker. I had 1,800 nanomoles of small LDL particles, the real cause for heart disease. I became a type 2 diabetic, and I was hypertensive. So here I am. I'm thinking I'm eating an ultra clean diet, right? Super low fat vegan diet. And I become a disaster, a metabolic disaster. I did this with about 100 patients also. Same thing. I called Ornish. I said, hey, what's going on here? We're doing your program and we're all becoming absolute metabolic disasters. He says, oh, no, you're not doing it right. You're eating too many white flour products. I said, no, we're not. We are absolutely not. Well, we almost came to blows over the phone. But so that was an illustration, Dan, how destructive a diet can be that causes numerous diseases. So that was one lesson. Another lesson came when my mom died of coronary disease. She died of sudden cardiac death about 4 months after her successful two-vessel coronary angioplasty. She was living in New Jersey, where I grew up. Well, I was in Milwaukee setting up new technologies in the hospitals to do these kinds of things, open arteries. And my mom dies of the disease I was trying to manage. But it taught me, Dan, how inadequate it was to try to manage a disease like heart disease in a hospital laboratory, a cath lab. It's a terrible way to do things. It pays really well. And it's actually a lot of fun to do these kinds of procedures. It's very exciting, but it is lousy for your health. So we wait for you to have a heart attack or some similar process before we intervene. That's a terrible way to manage a disease. Why not instead prevent it in the first place? Well, we help publish these data. So one of the ways we were tracking coronary disease, coronary atherosclerosis, is by getting a coronary calcium score. Calcium occupies about 20% of total atherosclerotic plaque volume. That's the stuff that gunks up your arteries. So if there's 10 cubic millimeters of atherosclerotic plaque in one of your arteries, you have 2 cubic millimeters of calcium. We can use calcium as a dipstick, a gauge, how much plaque you have. Well, I set up Milwaukee Heart Scan back then. This is 30 plus years ago. We're scanning people left and right. These are people like you and me, going to work, riding your bike, going for walks, not in the emergency room with chest pain, just going about your business. Well, when you look for silent heart disease, you find it everywhere, Dan. It's everywhere. The business guy says, you know, I'm 52. My dad had a heart attack at 55. I want to see if that's in store for me. He's got a score, say 400, which is very high. Normal is zero. Well, if he did nothing, which is not wise, the score would be 500 a year later, 25% higher. Another year later, 625, another 25%. He's closer and closer to dying, having a heart attack, sudden cardiac death, having angina, whatever. Well, what if we put you on a baby aspirin, a high dose of Lipitor, a low-fat, low-cholesterol diet, and an exercise program? How fast does the plaque grow? 25% per year. It has no effect at all on that measure. Well, what do I do? I've got thousands of people freaking out on me, right? Just my score is going up. Of course, my colleagues, many of whom, sad to say, Dan, are unscrupulous and will do procedures on you, even though it's not needed. It's been shown conclusively. If you are going about your business, have no symptoms, and you have silent coronary disease, putting you through a heart catheterization to implant stents, to do a bypass operation, open chest, has no benefit for you. There's reasons for that. But it's done all the time, Dan. It's done all the time. That's why maybe your local hospital put on a $70 million wing for heart care, because it's the number one moneymaker. You know, 80 million Americans take statin cholesterol drugs, and there's been no reduction in heart attacks and other cardiovascular events. This is the status quo. What do you do then with these people who score? Well, it took me some trial and error, some zigzagging back and forth, but it led to a bunch of new lessons, like the power of vitamin D to stop. It was the first time when we added vitamin D to the program years ago, it was the first time I saw scores do that, drop dramatically. A score of 700 drops to 300 or something like that. It also became clear that reducing cholesterol was a completely ridiculous idea, has no impact whatsoever. And that's why plaque grows on statin drugs. It grows like crazy on statin drugs. Well, what's the driver? Well, there's many of them, but one of the primary drivers of the growth of plaque and thereby coronary calcium scores is the small LDL particle, not LDL cholesterol. LDL cholesterol is a crude indirect gauge of LDL particles. We can measure LDL particles, Dan. It's easy. I've been doing it for 30 years. So we measure LDL particles that cholesterol is supposed to be a crude index for. We can measure the particles themselves, but specifically the smaller particles. Smaller particles are very unique. They're better able to penetrate the walls of arteries and implant themselves and cause plaque. They're more adherent to structural tissues. They're more prone to oxidation and glycation, glucose modification, makes them much more harmful. And they last 5 to 7 days in your bloodstream, as compared to a normal large LDL particle caused by fat consumption, which is cleared by your liver in 24 hours. The small LDL particle is not cleared because the shape is different. The surface conformation is different, and the liver can't recognize it. So you have that slice of pizza or bagel, a bowl of ice cream with sugar, and it provokes formation of small LDL. You did that on Monday. By Saturday, it's still in your bloodstream, going round and around and around, adding to cardiovascular risk. Now, wait a minute here. American Heart Association says cut your fat and cholesterol, eat more healthy whole grains, and everything in moderation. a program to cause heart disease. That's the status quo, Dan. Sad to say.
I'd love to give a little bit more space to what your diet had looked like when you just mentioned this, that it was you were on for a period of time. It sounds like a low calorie, low cholesterol diet with a lot of foods that fit into that category. Tell me a little bit, if you can, about what that diet specifically looked like, what you were consuming every day. And then obviously it sounds like there was a pivot in your general philosophy about what was healthy to consume and how you think about that now, what you eat on a daily basis or you try to eat on a daily basis that you think is in alignment. Obviously, this is just for you, but I would imagine some of these principles might be and habits could be useful to others that you think is a relatively decent standard diet for people who are interested in living well and having a healthy life.
So back 30 some years, when I became a low fat vegan, I was eating whole grains, whole grain bagels, whole grain breads, whole grain pizza crust, whatever. No meats, no poultry, no fish, no added oils, no butter, no olive oil. Of course, no animal fats, just whole grains, vegetables, and fruit, period. Mushrooms, legumes, things like that. What most vegans are familiar with. And that made me a type 2 diabetic and made me a metabolic disaster and made about 100 other patients of mine. I was unwise enough to advise to do this because of the claim that it reverses heart disease. And of course, it does not. The diet that I advocate now is kind of, in our 46 chromosomes, we have a style of eating and needs programmed into our genetic code. So I tell people, imagine you saw a lion and it gored a wildebeest, tore open its abdomen, ate its intestines and its heart and the meat and pancreas and all that stuff. And you were disgusted. You said, we got to put a stop to this. So you capture the lion and you put it in a cage and you feed it kale and broccoli. What happens to the lion? It dies. Probably it might take a couple of weeks, but it's going to die. Because you're not providing its needs that are programmed into its behavior and genetic code. Well, humans are no different. There's a type of behavior, an eating behavior programmed into our genetic code. So if we weren't modern people who turned to a refrigerator and a supermarket and a smartphone and a car, what if we had got up this morning and had to eat? Well, how would you do that? Well, you'd grab a club axe or spear and you'd kill something. Might take you all day. It's not easy killing animals, even something like a rabbit or a squirrel or a deer. They're not that easy to kill or catch. But you kill them and you eat everything. You save the skin for shoes to cover your feet. You eat the pancreas. You eat the heart, the brain, the muscle. You eat everything, snout to tail. You also gather berries and edible plants, leaves and mushrooms and birds' eggs and fish and shellfish. That's how humans ate for the first 99.6% of our time on this planet. The remaining 0.4% is when we added wheat and grains, by the way. And when that happened, in desperation, if you see a wheat plant, a tall stalk of grass, you don't start, it doesn't make you hungry. Humans don't view wheat and grains as food, but we did so in desperation about 12,000 years ago. Because of famine, war, drought, all the things that happened to humans, and hungry humans were desperate. And they figured out they could eat the seeds of grasses. In this case, wheat, also millet and maize, the forerunner of corn. We found that we could isolate the seed, pulverize it with stones, and then reconstitute it in a stone bowl heated over fire, and you get a porridge. That's how wheat and grains were consumed for the first about 9,000 years of grain consumption. What happened to those humans, by the way, Dan, who first adopted the consumption of wheat and grains? Tooth decay went crazy. So prior to the consumption of wheat and grains, tooth decay, Dan, was almost unknown. Even though there was no toothpaste, no fluoridated toothpaste, no dental floss, no toothbrushes, no dentists, and almost no tooth decay, 1-3% of all teeth recovered prior to the consumption of grains showed decay, abscess formation, or loss, or misalignment. With the consumption of grains, 16-49% of all teeth showed decay, abscess, misalignment, etc. And so, of course, in modern times, we compensate by fluoridated toothpaste, dental floss, picks, dentists, all the things we have to do. But up until recently, when dental hygiene was not a very sophisticated practice, that's why in the Middle Ages, 19th century, people often had no teeth or had very few teeth. It was very common. That was a big problem. And so just that alone illustrates how grains are inappropriate for human consumption. There was also a doubling of arthritis. There was also the appearance, contrary to conventional advice, where they tell us you must have grains for B vitamins and fiber, which is complete utter nonsense. Grain consumption actually causes numerous deficiencies, especially of minerals, because there's something called phytates that bind calcium, magnesium, iron, zinc, and other minerals, and you pass them out in the toilet, makes them unavailable for absorption. So I've seen, for instance, lots of ladies, particularly females, from some unclear reason. Ladies have a lot of iron deficiency anemia. It amplifies the anemia that's caused by menstrual cycles, but they also bind the iron in their guts, the phytates do, and they pass it out in the toilet. And these ladies, a common story would be, my hemoglobin is 7, normal is 12. My hemoglobin is 7. I'm cold and tired and breathless all the time. They give me iron injections. They make me take iron tablets. They give me blood transfusions every few months. And then I stop eating grains, and my hemoglobin is now 12 within 2 weeks. It's a very potent effect. And so grains were never appropriate. So, but in effect, Dan, it's reverting back to the style of eating as best we can. So I know you're not going to grab a spear and go kill a gazelle today, but we try as best we can mimic that diet. So we eat meats, we eat the fat, never buy lean. What you can, most people become so squeamish, they don't want to eat organ meats anymore. So what you can manage, some people do something like this, for instance, ground liver and ground beef, mix them 50-50 and make a meatloaf, something like that. If you buy sausage, get sausage in casing, intestinal casings. Make broths, but by the way, not bone broth. Bone broth has been shown, that is prolonged boiling in the presence of vinegar. That's been shown to be very high in lead, toxic levels of lead. So I say make, doesn't sound very good, make carcass broth. Say you bake a chicken, you eat the drumsticks, you eat some of the meat, and you've got a bunch of ligaments and tendons and skin and bones left over. Use some of the bones and the carcass. Don't boil for a long time, maybe 4 hours to release the meat. Don't add vinegar. That releases the lead in bones. So carcass broth, much healthier way to get those kinds of things. Or because modern people have become so averse, so squeamish about organs, you can get such things as collagen and hyaluronic acid as supplements also.
I'm going to tell you a quick personal story that's happened between the last time we talked and now, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this. About 2 years ago, one of my best friends started to exhibit some rather intense bipolar symptoms. I was a married man with two young daughters. And there's plenty of detail in the story, but in short, this episode, which lasted months and months of time, I think in part because he had stopped taking lithium, led to an implosion in his life and his marriage and his ability to see his kids. His wife filed a restraining order against him, his now ex-wife. And it was the first time I had ever really witnessed to somebody very close to me go through severe, a severe mental episode like that in a way that was that destructive. And his life is coming around, I think, especially in the last six to nine months or so, in a positive direction. I've talked to him a couple of times, and one of the things that he swears by, probably the biggest thing that he swears by, is a change in his diet. And apparently he has been a part of a university study looking into how a keto diet can be helpful in mitigating symptoms of mental illness, particularly in bipolar symptoms. And I just wanted to give you that story, right? There are books that I'm noticing that have come out and become extremely popular since the last time we talked a couple of years ago, one of them being Brain Energy by a guy named Dr. Chris Palmer, who I hope to have on the show at some point, who talks a lot about metabolic health. And his own mother, I believe, was schizophrenic and may have even killed herself. And he is of the deep belief that a lot of that was caused by her standard American diet. And these are a lot of the subjects that we're talking to are interesting intellectually until something truly tragic happens to someone very close to you or to yourself. And it becomes just a far more pressing issue. So maybe I can dovetail on your comments related to your thoughts on diet and give you the floor to add anything else you might like to add in your judgment about the how mental illness is affected, exacerbated, made worse by what people may unknowingly be consuming in their diet on a daily basis, and what would be wise for people to consider potentially changing or eliminating from their diet to help with some of those symptoms.
You know, the original suspicion in the 1940s that wheat was a psychoactive substance came during World War II, when there was a shortage of bread. There was no bread. And the hospitalization for schizophrenia, paranoid schizophrenia, dropped precipitously. So it was a hint that wheat doesn't cause schizophrenia. It unmasks it. It brings it out. So one of the original observations from the highlands of New Guinea by a doc named F. Curtis Dohan. He was a primary care doc from Philadelphia. And he did some field work with anthropologists and sociologists in New Guinea. And he noticed in this population of 6,000 people that there was, you know, schizophrenia is pretty obvious. People yelling, gesturing, talking to God, all kind of crazy stuff. They're hallucinating. Well, he saw almost none in this population of 6,000. I think he saw seven people with the signs of schizophrenia. Well, these Western researchers were trading with these people. You know, here's some beer and cornbread if you give me that shrunken head or whatever, animal skin or something. And he saw 70 people develop the signs of schizophrenia. So hints that this was true. And subsequent work has validated that, that wheat, when I say wheat, I mean all grains, because they're so promiscuous, they share genetics, like millet, sorghum, oats. There's lots of commonalities among grains. So over and over again, it's been shown that whether it's paranoid schizophrenia, bipolar illness, particularly the manic phase, also depression, suicidal ideation, binge eating disorder, bulimia, and some other conditions are all unmasked, not caused, but unmasked in somebody who's genetically prone to those conditions. And take it out. Not easy to do, by the way. It's very difficult to persuade someone with paranoid schizophrenia to change their diet. They love goodies like candy and cookies and cakes. And it's a very difficult thing to do. But if he could do it, as was done, by the way, several times in clinical trials, in locked wards, mental health wards, where they controlled the diet and medication and coming and going, they took all wheat and grains out of the diet and watched people with paranoid schizophrenia dramatically improved, not cured, but their hallucinations were much reduced. Their paranoid ideation was much reduced. Auditory hallucinations were reduced. Add it back, it all comes back. Take it away, it all goes away. That research, by the way, that came out of the 1960s and 70s, largely forgotten in the age of psychoactive drugs. And it's coming back, by the way. I think I was part of it. We're kind of reigniting interest in this idea that wheat and grains are psychoactive drugs. But the most common effect is not so much mental illness. It's appetite stimulation, very powerful appetite stimulation. So the gliadin protein of wheat, people say gluten, but it's actually the gliadin protein within gluten, is very poorly digested. We don't have the enzymes to break it down. You eat an egg or a piece of beef and you break it down to single amino acids. That's how you turn it into skin and other organs. Well, you eat the gliadin protein of wheat, you break it down into four or five amino acid long peptide fragments. And these have opioid properties. They bind to the opioid receptors of the brain and they're very powerful appetite stimulants. They amplify appetite. And that's why you see people, they can't stop eating. They have breakfast at 7, they're hungry at 8:30. All those things, they love the all-you-can-eat food buffets because they can't stop themselves. This is all. And by the way, of course, the big food manufacturers know about this. And it's probably the reason why. This is my speculation. In the 1980s, we saw the appearance of wheat and other grains in virtually all processed foods. Sugar also. Sugar has not quite the same effect, but some overlapping effects also. So we see wheat flour and related grains, cornstarch, cornbread, cornmeal, et cetera, in virtually all processed foods because they amplify appetite, they increase sales of processed and all processed foods.
I want to close the conversation. I know we're getting close to the end of our time together. I know we're slightly over, but I would love to give you just the floor to add anything else to this conversation that you would like to share with a general population that is looking to you to get answers or at least try things that can help to improve their life. You just talked about sugar, which we've touched on a little bit. So if there's something about sugar you would like to add related to general health, I'd love to hear it. But anything else that you think would be practical advice that people can take away from this conversation that might be helpful for them, what to eliminate, what to add? I know we've covered some of this, but I'd love to give you the floor to close on any of those subjects you might like to add here.
We know this is a really tough concept for many people to embrace. This idea that we've got to stop thinking about treating conditions. So if you're in the conventional healthcare world and somebody has a high blood glucose, high blood sugar, you treat it with a drug to reduce blood glucose, reduce blood sugar. Somebody has a high blood pressure, you treat it to force blood pressure down. Somebody has high cholesterol, you treat it to reduce it. So I tell people, stop thinking that like that. Instead, think about this. Let's restore the factors that are largely absent from modern life. So eat the foods that are, whose needs are programmed in your genetic code, get nutrients largely lacking because of lifestyles. For instance, we have to get magnesium because we use filtered drinking water. You can't drink from a river or stream. It's got sewage and other garbage. You have to filter your water. Water filtration removes all magnesium. Got to get vitamin D. You wear clothes. We work indoors. We work in northern climates, insufficient exposure to the sun, and we lose the capacity to activate vitamin D in the skin with sun exposure as we age. So get vitamin D. So let's revert back to the diet that's programmed, whose needs are programmed to your genetic code. Let's get nutrients largely lacking because of modern lifestyles. Let's reprogram our microbiome to get rid of those fecal microbes or reduce their populations, push them down from the small intestine, restore selecting important species like Lactobacillus reuteri, Lactobacillus gastrii, and some others. And you do that largely with fermented foods, as well as specific species like Lactobacillus reuteri. You do that, we're not treating anything. We're restoring human life to the way it was. What happens? You lose abdominal fat, type 2 diabetes almost always goes away, hypertension is gone, high triglycerides, fatty liver goes away, rosacea, psoriasis. And we mimic the lifestyles of people who still live this way, right? They hunt and gather, and they don't have any of the hot modern conditions. Thankfully, one of the things healthcare sucks for a lot of reasons. But one of the things it's good at is treating infections and injury. If you're in a car accident, break your leg, or if you have an infection, modern healthcare is good at those things. Modern healthcare is terrible at managing the disease of civilization because they still think it's a drug or drugs for every condition. We need to get away from that. Let's instead address the factors that allow disease to emerge. And more often than not, dozens, hundreds of health conditions go away.
Fascinating. Bill, I am so glad we were able to do this again. And I would love to do this again periodically throughout
Absolutely,
the rest of our lives to chat more about this. But I really appreciate your time and all the thought and energy you put into human health. So thank you so much for coming on the show again.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for doing what you're doing, because big media ain't doing it anymore. So we got to rely on people like you to broadcast the truth.
Thanks, Bill. Thank you for listening to this episode of Keep Talking. If you're finding value in this podcast, please consider supporting the show via the links below on Venmo, PayPal, or Patreon. Your support helps to make these conversations possible.